He's been one of the biggest advocates of AI art from the early days when artists began minting AI artworks on the blockchain as an artist, collector, and thought leader. Today, we're thrilled to welcome Clown Vamp to the show to discuss all things AI, including his first solo show taking place at Canvas 3 Gallery at the Oculus World Trade Center in New York City. Artist Journal, July 5th, 2023, broadcasting live from Berlin and an undisclosed location on Rug Radio via Twitter Spaces. My name is Adrian Pocabelli, and welcome, everyone. Welcome, Clown Vamp. I tell you, I'm so glad you showed up here, because RuneTune, the co-host, I have a feeling, had a late night. Clown Vamp, how are you doing?
I'm great. Also, I have like a tech question. So are you just playing the music next to a microphone, or is there some like fancy thing? Like, that's every time I watch on YouTube, I'm always like, what is going on? Like, how does that work?
So what I do, I'm very lo-fi. Like, so it's the same thing for the show. So for the Twitter space, what I do is I have my laptop playing just out of the laptop speakers.
And
I just put my phone right beside it. And and then for the show, I do the exact opposite, where I just play the phone into the microphone. And I actually like the song better with like that. Weirdly.
There's something kind of like cypherpunk about it that I like. When I listen, I'm like, oh yeah. Like, anyways, I feel like I'm on the set of like Oprah now.
Well,
it's like my mental cue. I like your art Oprah.
Yeah, we're the art Oprah, the underground Oprah of Web3 here. Welcome, Clown Vamp. I have a new title here. I love it already. You know, I just watched an interview with someone that works for Oprah, and it's funny. It's like, you don't call her Oprah, you call her Ms. Winfrey when you work for Oprah.
Oh, yeah, okay, sorry. Mr. Pocabelli.
Well, you can call me Adrian, but I guess that's what it's like for Oprah. So anyway, it's just a hilarious little tidbit. What a crowd that's coming in already for this show. So hey everyone.
It's going to be a very cool.
Yeah, it's going to be a very fun show. Clown Vamp is a very fun, exciting, positive individual. So it's going to be a ton of fun. So great opportunity today to come on stage, hang out, ask questions. And, you know, Clown Vamp, so here we are. Now, you don't need to, you're in an undisclosed location, and you probably like it that way. I assume.
I'm in an undisclosed location in New York City.
Oh, so you're in New York. Okay, that's what I was wondering. So how are things going? I mean, you just have this show that opened. You know, I know you from following the AI art thing as I discovered it. And I have to say, I was a little skeptical at the beginning. I was one of these people who said, you know, well, this is just pushing a button, even though it's pretty impressive what we're seeing. And, you know, over a few weeks, I kind of, you know, changed my view. And now I make it myself. And I'm a huge fan of the possibilities. So anyways, tell us what's new, what's happening, Clown Vamp.
Yeah. I'm kind of a little bit in sort of like a, you know, emotional hangover recovery. Like, you can have emotional hangover from positive feelings. Just so my solo show was a couple weeks ago. We did a one night only IRL sort of activation of it, which is the show was a recreation of a fictitious queer lost grandmaster painter. And the whole show was about pointing out the sort of missing pieces, the missing gaps in art history, and sort of the ways that art history reflects sort of contemporary and historic biases. And it was the show is, I mean, it was like my pinned post has a bunch of pictures from it, but it was so you know, we had the crowd was like one third NFT people, one third AI nerds, one third sort of like random people from my life. And it was really cool because, like, you know, the AI nerds were explaining to the non-AI people like how things work, and the people who had no familiarity with any of this stuff were just like getting really engrossed by the story. And so it was like incredibly self-actualizing and fulfilling, and it was just great. And The one edit on your very kind intro was I actually wasn't that early to AI. I was early to diffusion-based AI, which is sort of what we're all using today with Midjourney and Stable Diffusion and DALL-E. But, there were people working with GANs for years. And, it's been really cool to see the AI art community over the last year, just sort of explode. And a lot of people on the same journey I have, and you have too, which is like, there's this new magic, genie lamp that can do all these crazy things. And it's so powerful that I think a lot of us approach it with skepticism. And then there's some sort of like transformation into, acceptance and eventually, celebration of it. And so, I'm really glad to be here and I'm feeling good, working on some new projects and, kind of in art creating mode, which is a nice place to be.
Absolutely. And that's such an important point that you bring up. It's, there are people that have been doing this for probably near a decade, right? In the AI, programmers. There's a guy, Trueface, who has been programming. He makes his own algorithms, so very important point that you make there, because it has exploded. And that is kind of when it came on my radar. And interestingly, I was just since I had to crypto, I think. And then all of a sudden, you just kind of have this aha moment where you just kind of almost put your ego on the shelf for a second and you just accept that maybe this is a good idea. And once you, you load up MetaMask or you load up Midjourney and off you go, and you're almost never the same,
Totally. And I think it's interesting too, because the funny thing to me about AI art to this day is that, there's still people on this journey. You have people who've accepted crypto, they've accepted NFTs, they maybe even accepted generative art, but they haven't yet accepted AI art, right? And so it's like, everyone gets there eventually. And I think to me, crypto, and blockchain-based art technology and AI makes the most sense in the world. It's like two peas in a pod, right? If you're going to have sort of the age of abundance where content is just, there's more content than you could have ever imagined, then on-chain provenance is going to matter a lot. And so one thing that, I don't talk about a lot, but I feel really strongly about is the sort of on-chain nature of it. And I think that actually matters quite a bit. And I think, I'm sort of a big believer that when it comes to NFTs, digital art is the sort of natural medium for NFTs. And I think AI art is the most natural potential category of it, because you have so many interesting questions around provenance and, creation and all these things. And, blockchain, solves a lot of that. And so, I actually think when we think about NFTs and we think about what does the world look like 10 years from now, I think that AI art and the corresponding sort of art movement is going to be one of the biggest boosters to the NFT sort of ecosystem generally.
Fascinating. So, and you're like a big collector as well. And so like you have a lot of conviction, you might say, in this space. So what was your aha moment then? Because like, tell us a little bit, like, and very briefly, like, when did you get into crypto? And then when did you have like the AI, like, was it before Midjourney or at Midjourney? Or just tell us a little bit about the background.
So my crypto journey was maybe similar to a lot of people on this call, really stop and go. So, I think I looked it up. I forget if it was 2012 or 2013. I think it was 2012, my first Bitcoin purchase. And then it was like, very shortly after was my first sale. Like I bought it, I think it doubled or something, and I sold all of it. And I was like, wow, I'm really smart. Like I got one on them, like I was like, that turned out to be really dumb, obviously. And so I went through like a long period in the woods of just like every couple years sort of building up the conviction that maybe this isn't a scam, buying it, and then it going up and then thinking, okay, well, maybe it's probably just a scam. I should sell it and, count my blessings. And so I was a crypto skeptic up until late 2020, early 2021. And I got onboarded sort of for real with NBA Top Shot, which, is sort of, I think it was a lot of people's onboardings because, you didn't need a MetaMask wallet, you just needed a credit card. And I don't like basketball, but really enjoyed, you know, I was, as a kid, I was always collecting Pokemon cards and I've always liked collecting things. And so there was just something, you know, primordial that this was scratching and I just fell in love with it. And I fell in love with NFTs and that led to collecting PFPs. And then, you know, I was a really active participant in PFP summer and then eventually got burned out, you know, started the Clown Vamp sort of persona account, you know, I don't know what exactly you call it, to be able to focus on art. And, you know, originally just collecting art. And then March of 2022, the Midjourney beta was going on and people were starting to post things they were making. It was a private beta. I think they were on Midjourney V2, I think was the model that was currently being used at that point. And, you know, it was just one of these things of like, I was like, whoa, these, and now if you look back at them, they look like, you know, pieces of melted wax. But at the time I was like, this is amazing. And started like collecting a few pieces. Some of the early stuff I collected was like, you know, Rare, who now is a really successful super rare artist. You know, Indy, who might be on the call, you know, Indy Sulta, Nikita, and got really fascinated. And then Xerox, who's a really popular Tezos artist, you know, he was playing with these things. And I asked him if he could help me get an invite to the beta. He got me an invite to the beta. And from there, it was just like game over. Like, I think I spent the amount of hours of my life that have since been redirected towards creating AI art is just, you know, it's a huge percentage of my time. And, you know, it was pretty immediately love at first sight, even, you know, looking back at these like weird, you know, sort of surrealist candle waxy images, there was something about the experience of, you know, taking an idea and having it come out the other side and the experience of massaging that was just, it was meditative, it was fulfilling, it was, you know, it scratched the storytelling itch that I have. And yeah, it was game over from there.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that it was time well spent, and it worked that it was taking so much of your time, because it does feel like time well spent. I mean, I spent a lot of my morning this morning making AI art or just fooling around with it. And I think that's a key kind of part to understanding, you know, the getting past the, is this just pushing a button sort of idea, because it's actually quite hard to do, I would argue, to make like what I would call, to get the results you're looking for in AI art. Like, you do have to sit with it for quite a few hours to start to, you know, get somewhere with it. So I guess my question for you is, how long did it take for you to start to get somewhere as an artist? So you got in the beta, maybe that was like April or May, about a year ago?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, over
it's
a year
like 13,
ago?
13, 14 months ago, yeah.
So how long did it take you for you to get somewhere? Was it almost right away?
I was iterating a lot. And then in May of 22, I started getting somewhere. And it was playing with some different styles and aesthetics. And one that really stood out for me was I started, you know, creating, I was sort of playing with the constraints of it. And, you know, the melted wax, one of the few sort of formats that it played well with was impressionist art. And I really like impressionist art. And I really, you know, I think it's also something that people, you know, there's something about impressionist art that to me is kind of funny of like, if you've never, you know, even if you don't really like art, you know what impressionist art is, probably because of Van Gogh and some of these like highly popularized parts of the art canon. And so there is something sort of punk rock to me about playing with that out of this, you know, AI system. And I created this, and I've since actually minted it. I call it my style genesis, but it's on Tezos, but it was a UFO and an impressionist art style. I actually minted it much later once people started liking some of the stuff I was doing. I was like, oh, I should mint this. And so it's minted. It's like a 1 of 10. And, but anyway, it was an impressionist UFO. And there's something about it that just was really striking of A, at the time, these, you know, Midjourney was actually able to create sort of decent-ish impressionist art compared to a lot of other styles. Like, it couldn't create a photo very well. And there was something really brain glitching about seeing, you know, some semi-coherent piece of impressionist art with a UFO in it. I remember I showed it to a friend who's not involved at all in sort of this stuff. And I was telling him how excited I am about, you know, AI and how I've been playing with it. And he was like, this is really cool. Like, I'd hang this in my house. And that little comment was just like, you know, sometimes I think when you're creating art, other people don't know how maybe conflicted you are, how anxious you are, or how nervous you are. And even small comments of support can mean a big thing. So that little comment actually sparked a lot of feelings of, okay, maybe there's something here. And so I kept working on it and you know, developed this idea of this story of an impressionist painter who witnesses an alien invasion and has to, has to sort of express his creativity in this post-apocalyptic world. And he starts to paint these scenes and it started to build this universe and this world. And I started minting those the first week of June, 2022. And, pretty immediately found a lot of kindred spirits and people who like this sort of storytelling. And I don't know, it was super thrilling and fun. And, you know, ever since then, I've just been really focused on thinking about how you can use these tools to tell stories, whether that's explicitly a story, right? Or just more conceptually putting people into sort of a sense of alternative reality or alternative world and letting them sort of feel that experience too, even if it's not explicitly a quote unquote story.
Yeah, that is one of my, one of the most interesting things about your work. Actually, is from my perspective, I believe you've used the term visual novel, right?
I don't, but you have a lot, which I really like. But I think you've memed it to yourself into existence, which I like. That I'm like, we should use that now. You're gonna tell people that I called you the art Oprah, and I'm gonna tell people you called me a visual novelist. So we're.
I love it. You know what's funny about that? Because the first series I did with like oils after I learned how to oil paint properly back in like 2011, it was called Futures and Options and it was 12 paintings. And it was kind of like, I called it a visual novel.
Oh, cool.
And then I just kind of let it go. I was only half done. I got six done. It took me 3 years to get six paintings done. And I was just like, this is a total failed business model here. I'm barely making any work. But it kind of stuck, but it's funny how, when I see what you're doing, I mean, yeah, you're a visual novelist, the private eye stuff and everything. So
I want to see, your paintings, by the way. You should scan those and show people.
You know what? I will.
Yeah.
I'll make a note to myself.
Yeah.
I'll make a note to myself tomorrow. I'll show some of the futures and options.
Boom.
Thank you for the idea and the inspiration, Clown Vamp. So tell me, I'm curious, did you have artistic ambitions then before AI? Because I think a lot of people actually, I get the impression, and I could be wrong, but I think there's like a significant percentage, let's call it 10 or 20% of the artists on the blockchain. I sort of got the impression that a lot of people started just because in 2021, there's incredible bull run. There's money to be made. So maybe I can put some sketches together, especially if you're in a poor country. I mean, this was unbelievable money. So, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that either, by the way. I think that's actually really cool. Who knows how you stumble into these things? I'm curious about you. Like, did you go to art school or was this kind of a late thing and you're just like, let's try this?
So my background when it comes to sort of arts and creativity is kind of fun, I guess. I, in middle school and high school, was like really my sort of primary identity outside of being a kid was being a photographer. So I was like obsessed with photography. You know, I like built a lighting studio in my basement. I did a lot of sort of portraits and band shots for like the emo and pop punk bands near where I grew up. Like that was sort of my shtick. I would go to like concerts and festivals and take photos for like online zines and stuff. And you know, it was kind of a fun way also to go to free concerts, which was like a good hack. And so I was obsessed with photography, learned a lot about like Photoshop and composition, all these things, and had a sort of flirtation with, do I want to go and be a professional photographer, and ultimately decided no. And so I sort of left the visual arts behind when I was, 18, and then went on a sort of a crazy journey, involves a lot of different things. Eventually found writing as one of the things that I really love. And started doing a lot of writing, both nonfiction and fiction, and sort of the IRL world. I'm sort of more known for nonfiction writing, and I got really interested in storytelling, and I was trying to find ways to do more things in fiction, and that was around the same time that AI Art sort of found me. And so when AI Art came into my life, it was, I'd been exploring a lot of different ways to do more fictional storytelling, and it hit this sort of like, it's like when you learn a language as a kid and then you go back, you know, it's like I took Spanish in high school and I don't know any Spanish, but if I go to Spain, I can kind of somehow all of a sudden I'm like, quiero, you know, like I'm like speaking Spanish. It's kind of a similar thing where there was like, it was activating a bunch of these neurons that from photography, whether that's like curation, composition, color, lighting, you know, white back, like all these things, which, you know, were deeply sort of ingrained. And I spent, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours on, kind of put to the side, brought them all back. And at the same time, it was hitting on this need I had to tell more fictional stories. And so there was this weird, you know, I tell a lot of my friends who've known me for a long time that this is the most sort of self-actualized thing I've ever done, where it's a lot of my interests compounding all into one, all at the same time, in a way that's just like super bizarre. Like if you, my friends who know me, it's like, I love tech, I love creativity, I love art, I love like exploring new things. And so this was like perfectly built for me. and I think that's been true for a lot of the AI artists that I collect or I'm friends with, is that a lot of people have come here through really different paths, right? Some are incredibly skilled traditional painters. Some have never picked up a paintbrush. Some are big fans of art, but never thought they could express themselves. And for whatever reason, this new sort of method of creation really spoke to them. And I think that's one of the things that's most exciting and liberating. And, you know, one thing I think that's really cool about it that I talk about a lot is, you know, you sort of are talking about also the way that like people all around the world sort of access NFTs and all stuff. And, you know, a lot of the artists I collect are in, you know, countries I've never visited. You know, would be very, very long plane rides to get to. And one of the things that seems to me at least most exciting, and I think when we look back at this moment in history, 30, 40 years from now, we're going to talk about the fact that AI art is, you know, going to be one of the most accessible, least gatekept forms of art creation, right? Whether that's the fact that many of the tools are literally free. You don't need to have a super powerful computer because you can use, you know, Google Collab, and it's all in the cloud. So you don't even have to have a GPU really that's decent. And then, you know, the fact that, it's this sort of punk rock sort of thing that a lot of traditional people maybe look down on has created a lot of space for non-traditional, you know, people to sort of come in and take up some of that space while it's still sort of growing and there's still sort of room. So I'm really excited about the cultural significance of AI art as this like uber, the world is flat art movement that, you know, I think is going to, when we look back on it, be quite striking. And I'm sure we're going to have, you know, a bunch of famous names that, you know, come from countries that are not in Western Europe or North America. And I think that's really exciting to me too.
I totally agree. And it feels like, it's one of the hallmarks of this whole space is how truly international it is. And it's effortlessly international. It's totally. Not like these shows, you know, that happen in, you know, Western cities where it's like, okay, let's put an effort in to include people. Here it's just like, it's truly an international situation. And in a weird way, I mean, digital art, as many people have pointed out, has been happening, you know, at least for 50 years. But in a weird way, it's like that democratization that you're describing. It kind of feels like, in a weird way, it still feels like the start or another start of sorts. Totally. And again, this kind of this punk rock aspect, I think that's a really great way of putting it, because even pixel art, for example, you don't necessarily need to have like a very good hand at drawing
totally.
To make pixel art. And then this is the next, you know, and pixel art's huge. And it's sort of like AI art. You know, those are almost two big categories that are really just kind of native to this space to a certain degree. And I feel like AI art's the same thing. Like you don't need any training.
Totally.
Like you just need an eye.
Totally.
I mean, is art.
And the thing I'm sort of interested in, I'm curious your thoughts, because I know you think a lot about this stuff, is one thing that I'm playing around conceptually now with my art sort of going forward, and a lot of things I'm working on right now, but I'm also just thinking about is, as these models become more perfect, you know, what does that do to AI art with a capital A, right? Like, does that mean that the creativity moves to these sort of really down the line applications of these things, whether it's like making movies or really sort of complicated things that are empowered by AI? Or does it mean that people sort of, you know, in the same way like glitch art, for example, you know, people are doing a lot of glitch art with analog systems. Do people sort of stop in 2022, 2021 era models and say, you know, this is what AI art is, I'm going to use these models? So I don't know. I'm curious what you think, because I've been wrestling with that a little bit, this sort of balance between taking the AI out of it and keeping the AI in it, if that makes sense. And I feel like that's like a big unsettled question.
I think it's a very interesting question. Like when you say that, I think of the, you know, the classic, you know, fingers,
yeah, yeah,
like seven fingers, for example, right? Which one assumes, you know, in the it's already starting to disappear, but you still see it, you know. But yeah, so it's an interesting question. I mean, so it almost comes down to, I think the tools, there might be a shift in how they're used. I mean, what's interesting for me, just from a personal point of view, I was never overly excited with the results that I got from the Imagine prompt, speaking with Midjourney. I tried and I tried different things, and I got, you know, I had this Bacchanal sort of one, a couple of Bacchanal kind of pieces, you know, pastoral, had like really drunk Bacchus figure. You know, I liked those, but it was for all the prompts that I got a lot that I wasn't particularly excited about. But once I discovered Blend, that changed everything for me. Like, I mean, right now, what I'm really excited about is I take my art and I put it into Blend and I go, oh, now I want to try this one. And then maybe I'll put four of them into Blend. Maybe I'll just put, you know, the same different versions of the same one into Blend. So I wonder, I think there's so, like, and they're putting out new features practically every day here. I have a feeling that maybe the focus might shift from, like, now I think there's, or at least in the last year, let's say, there's been a lot of excitement, one might say, with what I call these AI distortions, right? Like seven fingers and all the, almost the glitches, one might say, that are produced by AI art. I wonder, because now, and this kind of brings us back to your UFO, the brush strokes are getting so persuasive. They're starting to, frankly, they're starting to look more beautiful than what you see, you know, when you're in the Getty there looking at these 18th century paintings, right? So can you speak about the brush strokes a bit? Because you're doing this impressionist show. It seems to me, if I had to guess, that was like a big draw for you, because with the UFO impressionist piece and this kind of focus on texture.
Yeah, I definitely would say, you know, sort of to piggyback off what we were talking about, like, you know, one of the ways in the recent few, you know, months I've been exploring the fact that AI has become super powered. It's like, you know, okay, as it gets better and better, but let me like drive the Ferrari as hard as I can, essentially. And you know, texture has been one of the ways of exploring that. And so I built, I've always been really resolution upscale focused. So even if you go to some of my earliest pieces, I've always spent a lot of energy trying to get them pretty high resolution. Because, you know, for those of you who haven't tried it yet, a lot of these models, you know, Stable Diffusion, you know, 1.5 will create a 512x512. Stable Diffusion XL, I think, is 1024x1024. Midjourney is a bit bigger, but none of it's that big. And so getting the resolution higher, and part of that is, for me, a texture thing and playing with these ideas of realness. And so, you know, I want you to be able to zoom in and look at it and be like, well, shit, this must be real, right? And like that, because it's not real, at least not real in the sense of, you know, there's, you know, a piece of wood or canvas somewhere that has it. And so, yeah, so I basically, you know, will do a multi-step process of upscaling that involves, you know, I'll create my initial pieces of work and, you know, pretty much anything. These days it's been a lot of Midjourney. Then I bring it into Stable Diffusion. I use a lot of their tile workflows that basically split up a piece in tiles and then re-render each tile. And you can do that multiple times with multiple iterations. And there's all sorts of things you can do. Like I have a bunch of custom texture files that I've made that I can lay over an image in Photoshop. You know, I turn multiply on and I, you know, put that on and add sort of texture. I do that. Then I run it through Stable Diffusion and it takes those little details and sort of extrapolates them into more intricate details. And so that's been one way that I've been reckoning with and dealing with these sort of questions of, okay, as AI becomes more superpowered, what does it mean to use AI art? And one of the ways I've been dealing with it is by trying to run the race car as hard as possible. But I don't know if that's sustainable, right? Because I think the race car is going to turn into a rocket ship pretty soon. You know, I've been exploring Gen 2 and these text-to-video models, and you know, it's totally shocking. And you know, fast forward a year, it's going to be even more shocking. And so I don't know. That's sort of one of those things where there's part of me, and this is maybe my personality, but I know a lot of people have sort of been in a similar boat, where there's part of me that says, okay, I want to just take the rocket ship and go as hard as possible and create the most intricate, over-the-top AI details. And there's another part of me which wants to just, you know, use old models and create, you know, weird seven-finger art. And, you know, I think wrestling between those two modes is actually going to be a lot of fun. But that's at least how I've been dealing with it. So,
absolutely fascinating. And I was going to ask you if you only use Midjourney or other things. So you also use Stable Diffusion, but primarily Midjourney. And I imagine you look at other stuff.
Yeah, too. I use all of it. So I would say, like, you know, I use, recently I've been using Midjourney, but then, you know, Stable Diffusion XL 0.9 just came out, which is, you know, equally as good. And so I've been exploring that. And, you know, a lot of times my workflow will look like, you know, I'll create something in Midjourney, but, you know, it'll use, you know, image prompts too that were maybe originally created Stable Diffusion, where I like the textures but not the image quality. And then I'll, you know, do a lot of inpainting with DALL-E, or I'll use the stability plugin in Photoshop to do inpainting, and then I'll bring it to Stable Diffusion to upscale. You know, so it's like there isn't really there isn't like one tool I'm sitting in. Yeah, it'd be nice, but I kind of like the chaos of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally fascinating. And welcome Runetune to the show. I guess Runetune had the plumber over. Runetune, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Sorry for the tardiness. Yeah, when plumbing calls.
There are no exceptions.
Did you get a no exception. Is it fixed, or are we still dealing with
the plumber? It's all good.
Okay. I'm just worried there.
Yes.
The leak has stopped.
I did actually try and swing over to the Oculus the other day. Unfortunately, the canvas gallery where your show was at was closed. I'm not sure. Is it still up?
So no, it was a one night only thing. There's a virtual version though.
Bummer.
Yeah. There's a virtual version. If you go in my pinned post, you can find the virtual version. But the canvas gallery is pretty cool. It's like this company that basically takes over vacant space in malls and turns them into all sorts of different experiences. And the one in New York has a partnership with Supercheap and Super Rare and Transient Labs. So there's sort of like rotating shows in there. So it's not like there's like one permanent show, but we had this.
Matt, when I walked by there and looked through the window, even though it was closed, I could tell that it wasn't going to be the show of your work that I
was seeking
out.
Thank you for taking a look. I appreciate that.
Oh yeah. No, I really wish that I could have been there on the 21st. I was out of town that day. But otherwise, I would have done anything to be there because that sounded like it was such an incredible show.
Thanks. I appreciate that. It was really great. I felt very, I was like, I was happy and tired, which is a good dual emotions to be.
Yeah.
Well, the production looked excellent. I mean, you really did it looked like a pretty professional job, I guess, you and Canvas 3. putting all the booklets together, and it looked like there were title cards.
Yeah.
I mean, it did look very impressive. You had nice documentation.
Thanks.
I mean, we could see everything that was going on.
Thanks. Yeah, I was trying to, like, you know, I think one of the areas I'm interested in playing with is these, and a lot of the art I've been collecting recently even, is these sort of things that cross dimensions, right? So, you know, AI art that has a physical component, and, you know, for the Chester Charles show, the actual, you know, that opening party was part of the art, right? Like, people going there and having this sort of effect, you know, I had a couple of people be like, wait, it's not real? You know, like, that was really important to me, was this sort of alternative world, alternative thing. And to do that, you know, that meant, like, okay, let's have exhibit labels, let's have placards, let's have brochures, let's play with those things. And, you know, they're not that hard to do, right? But, like,
you know, it's funny you say that, because even when you were, like, announcing it on Twitter, I understood that it was, like, a fictional story, but I had to look it up just to be sure.
Yeah, I had a bunch of people who told me
that. Because it was that,
like, convincing. Yeah.
Well, it's totally awesome. Can you tell us a little bit about the story?
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't, how do we even read it? Because it looks to me like this is multi-chain. Like, I thought I saw a work on Tezos and one on SuperRare. Is that right, or am
I
mistaken?
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, if you go to my pinned post, there's a link to a Cyber Gallery where you can walk through it, and all of the text is actually in the gallery. So each piece has the sort of, in the virtual gallery, has the label. So basically, the story is that in 2021, there was this cache of lost art found that was, you know, hidden away because it was very gay. And, you know, the painter, you know, never achieved any sort of fame during his lifetime because he was painting and just sort of hiding it away, because it was too queer for the time. It was not something that, it would have been too much of a scandal. And so the story is that we found the art, and then this is a, you know, showing the art, and in showing the art, I have an artist note in the front, but then everything else is sort of with a wink and a nod that, you know, this is real. So there's, you know, sort of a bio card, and then each piece comes with a exhibit label that has a curator's description plus a recreation of an inscription that was quote unquote found on the back of the painting. And the idea was that the story exists on a few dimensions. So the story exists in the dimension of the concept, right? And the story exists in the dimension of the aesthetic and the art and the sort of aesthetic development of the artist over time. And the story also exists in the dimension of the inscriptions. And so, you know, you could approach the show from just saying, I want to look at a couple pretty pictures. You could approach the show from saying, I want to, like, read every single word of all the stories. And some people, it was really cool, like on the virtual version of the 21st, like, went and read every single part of the story. And if you read all the stories, like, there was drama, there's love triangles, there's all sorts of, you know, I got up to some mischief. And so,
are all of those details still available on the,
yeah,
you said it's on Cyber?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So if you go to my pinned post on that thread, there's a link to the on Cyber. And if you just walk up to any of the pieces, and to the right of each piece is the exhibit label that was also the same text that was found in the IRL show. I was basically trying to take this sort of container of a career retrospective and use that format as a storytelling tool, and all the sort of corresponding pieces that sort of come with that, right? So that's why things like the brochure were important to me. One, because I just believe that physical shows should have physical artifacts. Like, that's some, I don't know, there's something about it. Like, I just think that's really important. But I also just think there's something about, like, you know, this concept of a show as a retro is, like, we know what that sort of looks like and smells like. And because of that, you can sort of use that base to sort of fuck with people's heads and, like, play with these ideas because there's that, like, familiar baseline, you can then start to tweak it in, like, interesting and sort of fun, mischievous ways. So,
right. Like, you're using traditional gallery tools, like a booklet, the little white title cards, and you're saying, and here you have this kind of unconventional AI digital art show. Is that what you're
exactly
saying?
Exactly.
So it's kind of a way, right. You're, like, recontextualizing. But, like, you've substituted the content
yeah,
of a
yeah,
traditional
yeah.
art show. Yeah, fascinating. And so I guess a couple of comments. The first is, speaking of substitution, it's like in terms of the content, it does seem like a brilliant substitution. Your content there in an impressionist sort of process, right? Painting process. So the queer art show or the queer artist and subject matter hidden away and then putting it in a, you know, a new context where, of course, back then it would have probably been hidden away, if right? So that's quite interesting in itself. It seems like a nice fit. And as far as the, I'm also looking just at the, I'm curious about the production itself. Just one more question on actually putting on this show. I see like pictures of 9x16 screens in your header there on Twitter. Did you struggle with the ratios? Like, I guess you knew ahead of time that you're going to work with screens, a 9x16 ratio, but I assume it didn't look like to me on Superware that they're all 9x16. How did you deal with display?
Great question. So this has been an issue with a lot of AR, not AR, but digital art shows. I think in the last couple years has been the fact that, you know, artists don't really want to create 16x9, but yeah, that's a lot of these screens. And so I, you know, had the lucky, you know, I'm based in New York. And so, you know, I went to Canvas 3, like the show was, you know, once we sort of knew we had a location for it, you know, to give context, you know, there's 23 pieces in the show. It started in the thousands. And so, you know, I was able to curate down the show to sort of match that physical space. And so, you know, the show has 23 pieces because there was 23 screens at Canvas. Like they're really meant to be sort of together. And, you know, the screens at Canvas are primarily vertical, they're primarily portrait. So that also impacted the show from the perspective of, you know, most of the stories are portraits. You know, and so as a result, I did a lot of sort of character development. Like if you read the inscriptions of the show, there's certain characters that reappear throughout. Because of that need, and the couple more, I don't know what the term would be, but establishing shots, so to say, of the story, you know, a lot of them had to be done in vertical because of that constraint, even though I would have preferred to have done them in sort of landscape. And so that was fun for me, right? That challenge. And, you know, I only had a few sort of, you know, landscape screens to play with, right? So I had to be really intentional about how to use those. And, you know, I also had, you know, a wall in Canvas of, you know, these three screens that were big vertical screens right next to each other. And so I sort of thought about those three screens as an opportunity to do like sort of a grand portrait wall. Because I think about, you know, when you go to art museums, you know, sometimes you have these like big portrait walls, these, you know, giant frames. And so I was sort of playing with those ideas. And so, yeah, so that was part of the fun of it, was knowing where it was going to show. You know, we've been working on the show for a long time. So knowing where it was going to show, you know, allowed me to, in doing the sort of final curation, make all of that sort of line up in a way that was really fun.
Super. Would you ever...
Go ahead.
Would you ever consider, you know, maybe putting on this show again somewhere?
Totally.
Like, have you thought about, like, approaching other galleries and seeing what they might have to offer?
Yeah, no, totally. I definitely would be open to doing that. You know, it's like, it was meant to be experienced in this space, but it could definitely be reconfigured in other spaces too. So, yeah. Definitely.
I can imagine these paintings, you know, actually framed. Like, you take the digital screen and you actually frame it with one of those, like, really
those antique gold, you know,
19th century, antique gold frames.
You're kind of you're reading my mind a little bit, of not necessarily for this show, but in general, a lot of the things I'm playing with right now and some of the art I think you'll see me create over the next 6 to 12 months is just this sort of digital, physical, weird divides, and how do you play with those ideas and concepts? And, you know, I've been experimenting with different printers recently, trying to find like a printer, but You know, part of me is like, okay, you know, should I be selling prints that maybe come with those big gaudy gold frames or something? You know, like, I don't know, like I'm really fascinated by those ideas because one of my favorite things about AI art is the details and the ability to really like jam on the details and go really far and, you know, mess with people's heads and, you know, do that kind of stuff. Because to me, AI art is an incredibly like creative and tender activity. And I think people want to brush it aside with these sweeping statements, right? Like, oh, it's copying. Oh, it's theft. Oh, it's simplistic. Oh, it's push a button, you know, blah, 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 blah. And to me, so there's something about A, the details and going really far in the details that makes it harder to push away. And then two is there's something about crossing the digital physical barrier divide. I don't know what to call it. That also makes it harder to push away. Like, you know, when you show someone a piece of AI art in person, even if it's on a screen, there's something about it that sort of makes them go, well, it's here. I see it. I guess it's real. Like, it's not like, hard for me just to brush it away. Like, I see it. It's beautiful. Right. And so that idea is really fun for me and something I want to just play with and explore a lot.
You know, it seems like with a lot of your work, I mean, you're playing with storytelling all the time. And something that I like is it's always this sort of like interplay between fact and fiction.
Yeah.
Like you already pick subjects that are already like there's one foot in both sides of things with this like Chester Charles thing. Like, you know, depending on the way you would choose to present that story and that show, it could be, you know, oh, the lost paintings of the Grand Master, you know, Chester Charles, and people don't know that this is a fictional thing until they get there.
Totally.
And read about it. And then, you know, the earlier stuff that you were working with, like aliens and that type of,
totally,
you know.
Yeah, and I think there's part of me which is like, you know, yeah, there's like, you know, those ads, right, where it's like, I don't know if you, for those of you who are in America, there's this cheap shoe store called Payless Shoes, which did this famous ad where they, you know, put like a fancy logo on a empty boutique and sold their $20 shoes for $900 and filmed it and created an ad out of it. And like, there's, to me, it's too much of a gotcha, you know, like I would feel too bad about it. I like that concept in general of making people question why we assume certain things and, you know, but it's too much of a gotcha for me. So conceptually, I like those ideas. They seem a little like too, maybe it's too mischievous for even a clown vampire. So,
well, beautiful. And if anybody is out there, the time is moving fast. So especially AI artists, come on stage and come hang out with Clown Vamp and ask any questions you might have, technical or otherwise. Clown Vamp is very clearly well-versed and is a writer, IRL, so can describe his thoughts very clearly. I found it super interesting what you're saying, how you enjoyed the challenge of going vertical. And it's almost something I see a lot. Like, I see it in my own work. There's a bias towards the vertical in digital art these days, I'd argue, because we're, you know, you make a big wide landscape. I mean, people are looking on their phone half the time. It doesn't really work that well on a phone, but it also kind of makes horizontal works or landscape works kind of special,
yeah,
in a weird sort of way.
No, I totally know what you're saying. Yeah, and then there's square, which feels like perfect, like feels like the sort of norm. And there's all these weird ways in which this sort of constraints of our viewing impacts the art. It's actually quite interesting.
It's totally. I mean, I made this Peloponnesian War series, actually, which hopefully will go on Ordinals shortly. Let's see how that goes. But I made it all 4x5 because that was Instagram's, ratio.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I was like, this is, at the time, I didn't know anything about, there were barely NFTs. There weren't NFTs when I started that thing. And then, so it was basically, you put your digital art on Instagram, cross your fingers, and hope you get 100 likes, and off you go, right? So it is interesting. Yeah, it's something, and even now, I still have that bias, because half the time I'm working on the phone, right?
Totally.
So it's not like you're wanting to make big horizontal work on your phone. Speaking of the phone, like I use Discord on my phone and I love it because I can go make AI art like I was this morning. It's like you go anywhere.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
Waiting at the gym for the class to start. Do you use your phone primarily?
I use all of the above. So I will, so I have like a big screen, in the studio where I work. That's, you know, it's sort of my happiest place to work, but then I have an iPad and a smartphone, and I actually love the iPad and the Discord app for creating art. So like I'll go to a cafe and I like the, it's a bit bigger than the phone. It's tactile. Like I'm touching the buttons. There's something about it that's kind of fun. But then, you know, I'll have a prompt that I'm jamming on that, you know, is generally sort of where I want it to be. And, you know, maybe I'll be on, the, you know, I was on, yesterday I was like on the subway and I was just like, you know, re-rolling and editing and tweaking. And so, yeah, I mean, I use it all of the above. I definitely, have been the guy at the gym who's like lingering on a workout machine because I'm like re-rolling my prompt, which is some like real nerdy shit, you know?
I laugh because like, I do gym classes because I wouldn't do any exercise otherwise. And literally waiting for the class to start this morning. There I am.
Like, okay. Let's one more time.
Upload image. Yeah. Hilarious. And kind of a technical question. We kind of touched on, you know, the different kinds of prompting earlier with like Imagine and Blend. Do you like defer? Like, is there any, like, where do you normally start? Do you start with Imagine?
It just depends, I would say. So, you know, for example, so I have this series called Detective Jack, which is a choose your own adventure series on Tezos, which is, I call it Barbie Noir. So it's sort of a noir illustration aesthetic, but very pink and very sort of Americana. And, you know, I'm sort of playing with some ideas there. And, you know, for that, for example, you know, for the second season of it, because it's a month long sort of interactive adventure, I used images from the first season as image prompts for the art from the second season, but Midjourney had gotten so much further than the first season I had made on Stable Diffusion, that I was able to like create things that were much more coherent and aesthetic, but I used the colors and textures and sort of like vibe from the first. So it really depends. With the Chester Charles show, I used primarily no image prompts. It was primarily just text prompts and pretty convoluted text prompts because I had to mature and change the aesthetic development over time. So I kind of needed to like add and subtract quite a bit and you know, bring in different artist influences. And then, you know, Midjourney has this, you know, desire when you do stuff outside of photos, I find, to sort of make everything sort of, you know, tries to bring stuff into the mean, I guess. And so, you know, there's things you do for that, like Style Raw, Style Zero, you know, now they have like a weirdness thing. But the thing that I always found was most effective is using, you can have weighted text prompts. You can have multiple text prompts that you weight differently, which is probably the most powerful but underused feature in Midjourney. And so I would then also, I would have certain, you know, aesthetic descriptions that I would then use as multi-prompts that I would weight the different prompts differently. And I would maybe even change those a little bit over time to sort of reflect that like aesthetic development. So again, it all like kind of depends. And, you know, someone once said, this wasn't me, but someone once described, you know, AI art tools as sort of like different synthesizers. If you were making like electronic keyboard music, where they all sort of do different things, you know, they work differently. They all sort of, you know, explicitly, you know, you hit a note and that note comes out, but there's so much variation between them and how you manipulate them. And so for me, that's part of the puzzle. And part of what I enjoy is, you know, usually I'm starting with a visual image in my head, and then I'm trying to work towards that. And that process of working towards it is really fun. It's very meditative. But then also the response I'm getting from the system acts as a piece of feedback into that. And so, you know, it'll push me in certain ways, or it might like randomly, this happened to me the other day, it randomly brought up this idea that I was not expecting. And it sparked a whole bunch of other thoughts and pursuits and new visual images that I then was chasing down. And so that like meanderingness of it all is like, you know, so much of the fun.
I mean, you totally see how it feels infinite.
Yeah. How,
right? Like, I mean, I feel like AI really brings out that, you know, sense that really, like, with all the images that have been made so far, it's like, weirdly, it feels like we're only scratching the surface when you're making, you know, you probably have like 1,000 or more, maybe thousands of, you know, impressionist paintings that are kind of convincing.
Totally.
You know, as your Degas, you know, ballerina work is, you know, ballet work is, you know, it's a fairly convincing work. And here you're probably sitting on thousands of like unmade impressionist paintings.
Yeah, it's so funny. I use Adobe Bridge to organize everything. And, you know, there's something about your mind's eye that gets, you know, overly familiar or fatigued. And one of the things that's been really joyful for me now, you know, is looking back at some of the, like, the discards from a year ago and, you know, revisiting those with a whole new appreciation and perspective of them. And it's been really fun. And there's all sorts of things I'm like, wow, I really should have minted that. Or, you know, I wonder if I'll ever have an opportunity to use that. And yeah. And so there's definitely some weirdness there around, you know, my explorations of the latent space and what sticks out to you with a curator's eye at present. And then, you know, in the future. And yeah, I don't know. That's going to be a whole thing. I mean, think about like someone like Claire Silver, who has been doing this for so long, you know, is so successful at it, must have so many, you know, sort of extras, right? Like B-sides. And, you know, what are, is she going to mint those one day? Will it be like a B-side collection? You know, what even is a B-side? You know, I don't know. It's kind of fun.
Well, I love Claire Silver's take that, you know, really with AI art, taste is the your only limitation. Mm. Like that, and I totally agree with her. It's like that's what's so crazy about it, you know, with AI art. So a couple of quick questions here as well, just on the minting side of things. So why did you decide to go multi-chain? Because my sort of instinct would have been, oh, why don't you just put it all on super rare and this sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about the thinking behind that.
So it's a few things. So for context, the show is, you know, the series of one-on-ones minted on super rare. And then there's two open editions, one on Tezos and one on ETH. And I think, like, I really like people being able to be involved. Like, I think part of coming to this with a collector's mindset is I think I have a sort of empathy, appreciation, love of collecting that, you know, I'm like, you know, even when there's something that's maybe, you know, I don't know, it's like, you know, the one of ones, you know, sell for, you know, like 2 ETH and like, that's like not accessible to most people, but you still want to be like a part of it. And you want to like, whether, you know, you want to build your collection and have things. And so for me, having the open edition is like a cool way of building that community and like having people be able to be a part of it. And so I'm definitely a super like sort of OCD about like, you know, contract hygiene and all that stuff. And so there's a part of me which would, yeah, I'd love to have it all in one contract. That's the only place it is. But the part of me that wants people to be able to like touch and feel and be a part of something sort of won out. And I think luckily Deca and a bunch of other tools have sort of made that multi-chain issue, I think, less of an issue. And so like I'm working on, you know, my Deca artist profile and bring everything into one place. And so So you're scratching on an anxiety of mine, because I'm very like, how can I not have like 30 different contracts? But I think it's important to, you know, create ways for people to access art that are, you know, super expensive and all that kind of stuff.
Well, it's back to that whole idea that it's a feature, not a bug, that art on Tezos is so cheap.
Totally.
Right? Like, I mean, right. I mean, and you know, that as a collector, like I probably would have like 2 RJs and in that first work I collected way back when, you know, like I'd probably have 3 artworks in my collection if it was only on ETH. So, but luckily with Tezos, yeah, that's a completely different story. And it may not stay like that forever.
Yeah.
We might add.
Right? Yeah, I mean, obviously, also Tezos was at $5, a lot more expensive of a chain than it is right now, right? So,
well, it's a complete different story. Yeah. All of a sudden, selling for one Tezos for your edition of 20 is not such a terrible day.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like, so I hope it goes back up soon because I get a little worried about some you know my friends and stuff. But yeah. So Tezos sub $1 is not what we need.
Yeah, but a huge opportunity, perhaps.
Perhaps.
As long as, perhaps. If it doesn't go to 40 cents first, we shall see. And also just on the book front, you're mentioning, I guess the first thing is, were you happy with the prints that you were seeing? Because I think it would be quite a challenging thing to make a persuasive print of AI, but I do think it's possible. And I think I may have seen one or two on Twitter that I went like, oh, that looks really convincing. I can't remember the artist, if it was Lily Illo or someone else. How's your experience with just trying to print stuff out? Have you been satisfied with what you're achieving there?
Stay tuned. Not yet, but stay we're getting tuned. There. Work we're making progress. Yeah. Good question. We'll circle back in our 6-month reunion tour.
Good. And just finally on the another front, I think we lost Runtun. He maybe had to get back to the whatever's going on with the plumber. I hope everything's okay there. Just in terms of, you mentioned that in real life, you are a writer of nonfiction, you're flirting with fiction. Do you plan to turn any of these visual novels? Do you kind of conceptualize a book? I imagine you must have thought of this.
Yeah, I'm super interested in like different ways to explore these stories and, like books, one of them, I don't know, I've been playing with Runway ML and like, oh, should I do a movie, you know, like, so I'm exploring sort of all of it. Part of me, there's sort of a tension between using traditional, you know, using these traditional storytelling mediums and bring AI into it in a way that's sort of fun and exciting, right? And there's part of me which wants to just stick with, okay, well, what's like a new way to do it? Like, what's an interactive way to do it? What's, you know, what's something that's native to AI? So I did this piece last year that I'll pin that I was really proud of that I think is an example of this and something where I'm like, okay, how do I sort of do more things like this? But this was a piece I did for the Scope Art Fair where I'd recently gone and seen a Diane Arbus exhibit and, you know, she does all these amazing, you know, photos of, you know, people who sort of outside the normal bounds of society. And she has, you know, these photos of early, you know, drag performers in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, it's interesting is because, you know, Diane Arbus is sort of, you know, beloved by a lot of people, myself included, but there's a lot of people who sort of worry that was she taking advantage of people? Was she, you know, how did the people in the photos actually feel? A lot of that's lost to history. And so, you know, I had this idea of, well, you know, you could explore these emotions, right? You don't have to answer these emotions. You could explore them using AI. And so with this piece, I created using DALL-E, a, you know, retired, you know, called the Retired Royalty. It's one of the drag performers from the 60s. Now is a, you know, a person in their 80s. And then I created a GPT prompt that every time you ran it, gave you an interview transcript with that person talking about their experience of being in that famous photo. But every time you ran it, it gave a different answer. And so the idea is that it's to bring alive these questions of like, okay, well, how did they feel? And what are the different ways they might've felt and exploring these sort of things. And so this for me was really fun because obviously it's like playing with timelines and our history and all these things I really enjoy, but it's also a type of storytelling that is native to AI in a way, you know, an infinitely reusable interview transcript isn't really something that you can normally do. And so I'm also sort of, I don't know. So there's a tension there for me between wanting to like create new AI native ways of storytelling and then wanting to bring AI into traditional formats. And probably the answer is just I'll do both. So we'll see.
Fascinating. And before I pass it on to Runtun, actually, I have a couple of just tiny questions. First, do you use ChatGPT at all for your prompting?
Not for my prompting, but I am working on a project right now that has a heavy use of ChatGPT, and I don't want to alpha leak myself too much. So I'll leave it at that. But I haven't done a lot yet other than this one project here, where this isn't ChatGPT, this is GPT, the GPT Complete API. But I have ideas that I'm exploring for how to do more storytelling using, you know, GPT text.
Well, this may have previewed my next question, which was, what is next? But don't only tell what you can tell, and maybe you've already said what you want to say. But where are you going next?
I think a lot of where I'm going next is basically, I think there's like a few different tensions I'm playing with. So one is this tension I referred to around like the AI perfection versus AI, you know, artifact sort of tension, and how far to go on the perfect versus AI-ness of it all. So that's one. And then the second is sort of hyper-related, but, you know, doing storytelling that is sort of new to and native to AI and something you can never do before, and then doing storytelling that's bringing AI into traditional format. So I think those two, you know, maybe those are like XY axes that overlap, and maybe it's a grid or something, right? But like, those tensions are what I'm playing with and exploring, and going to do stuff all across those spectrums and sort of have fun with it. And, you know, maybe the answer is just even taking traditional formats and remixing them into like new AI, you know, native ways that could never have been done before. I don't know, you know, like, so a lot of stuff I'm exploring is around there, and mostly working on a few really big shows, and then, you know, working on more pieces of The Truth and, you know, a new Detective Jack series, and, you know, continuing some of those stories too.
Amazing. Well, it sounds fascinating and exciting, and it sounds like you have a lot going on. Runetune, do you have any other questions for CloneVent?
I guess, you know, I don't use AI tools quite as much as you do, I'm sure, but what are like some of the biggest struggles you have when you use those tools? Like for me, I mean, I mostly just use ChatGPT, but it always struggles to meet me where I need it to meet me when it comes to creating humor. There's a couple concepts that I think are really funny that I explore with ChatGPT, and it could never, it's great at analyzing, like when I tell it why something is funny, it's like, oh yeah, and it'll just like break it down and have no problem at all. But when it has to come up with its own thing, it gets a little bit too, it never lands on the mark.
That's, yeah, I would say one of the reasons I haven't used it for a lot of creative writing things yet is that I think it has this sort of amorphous professorial thesaurus tone that doesn't really work well with creative writing. And if you know how ChatGPT works, you know, basically the two things to understand are, a professor actually explained it to me this way, which I really love, which it's, you know, it's like shouting to a crowd of people, you know, the man went out to walk his, and then, you know, 90% of people would respond dog, maybe 99% would respond dog, but then, you know, occasionally it's not a dog, like there's some kooky people out there walking their cats and rabbits. And so, GPT models have this concept of a temperature, which is basically, in order to not have it become too repetitive, because oftentimes those prediction tasks are kind of obvious in their answer, they have this factor called the temperature, which basically adds a degree of randomness to it. And so maybe instead of saying dog, it would say puppy or cute dog, because it uses a probabilistic model of what are the most likely things. And so if dog was number one, but number two is puppy, or number three is maybe a breed of dog, it's beagle. And that randomness thing is like a really quirky concept intellectually, because, you know, sometimes when you're writing a sentence, you would use a lot of randomness and sometimes you wouldn't, but ChatGPT is always using a lot of randomness. And so you can, not in ChatGPT, but in the GPT APIs, you can mess with that variable a bit. But in general, the issue that it introduces is that you get this sort of thesaurus heavy, you know, forced randomness. So it's both very formal and has a lot of word variety that is just not how people usually write. And so I think they need to figure out how to fix that and how to, and anyway, but it's all to sort of say that, you know, these technologies are super emerging and, you know, there's sort of weird quirks in them that right now, you know, you can really use ChatGPT really well to cheat on your homework because, you know, it sort of writes like a college student who's hitting the thesaurus sort of heavy. But it's hard to, you know, write the next great American novel with it, but that's probably going to change, which is kind of crazy.
Very well said.
Yeah. And I've totally noticed that. Like, I mean, if you just use ChatGPT and you say, improve this text, I mean, it totally overwrites the whole thing, mm-hmm. right? Where it's like, and you could detect it. I'm sure if you use ChatGPT, you'll see it. It's almost absurd, right?
Yeah, totally. At times.
Which is kind of interesting. You start to see the limitations of this incredible technology, to your point. It's almost like an AI distortion of sorts, like we see with the fingers, but in text, interestingly.
Yeah, that's a good point.
As we close here then, as we wrap up here, CloudVep, do you have any final thoughts or thoughts? We have a lot of artists here and everything. What do you want people to know about you, your art, and AI, whatever you like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I still think, you know, AI art is sort of one of the bright spots in this crazy NFT bear market. And, you know, I think I'm incredibly, as a collector, incredibly optimistic about AI art's future. And, you know, definitely just encourage everyone to, you know, to the degree they can, you know, stick to it. I think that, you know, if you look at what's happened over the last year and you look at the excitement around AI and the sort of general population, I mean, that's only going to further, you know, it's only going to get more amplified. And I think as it gets more amplified, I think AI art as the sort of corresponding art movement is going to be, you know, become something that's even more on people's tongues. And so I just think you're all doing something that's incredibly important. It's historic. It's, I think it's what people, you know, spend their careers dreaming of, you know, being in a moment in time where the sort of cultural moment is meeting an art moment and, you know, they're able to be in part of it. And so I just, I encourage everyone to just, you know, keep creating. And I know it's a super hard time and, you know, but even if it's slowing down, just, you know, encourage everyone not to stop if they can avoid it.
Beautifully put. And I think that's profound what you're saying. And I feel like that just in the digital art space, in the NFT art space in general, that we're so lucky to be a part of something that feels like an art movement is happening in our, while we're here, you know, while we're present, and it's accessible to everybody.
Totally.
I mean, it's really, and that in itself makes it historic, no matter what,
totally.
like just by default. So profound words to end on. And Runtune, do you have any final thoughts?
I think you're very right when you say, you know, we all hope to be in those sorts of intersections of, you know, art history and stuff. And I think you're doing just that. And I think that Chester Charles show was like a great use case for AI to kind of like reclaim an untold history in a creatively fictitious way.
Thank you. That's really sweet. It was like a really fun all of my interests in one. And if any of you ever come over my apartment, I have this giant stack of gay history books and gay coffee table, like gay art coffee table books on my coffee table. And so it's just, you know, a lot of my interests in one. So it was really, I don't know, felt really like a big warm hug to have people enjoy the show. And so I'm really grateful and appreciate you guys having me on. Someone tweeted that I sound like I'm in a garage. I'm sorry about that. I do have concrete floors in here and need to get a rug or something. So good point.
All good. I almost thought it was a voice transformer when you started. But I was like, No, but all good. And thank you so much, CloudVep. That was absolutely fascinating. And thank you for sharing a lot of what you do. I mean, you share a lot of your trade secrets here. And it is totally appreciated.
Listen, anytime,
anytime the Art Oprah wants to invite me on this show, you know, I'm here for it. And Runtune, you missed it, but I named Pokebelly the Art Oprah. And so now we need to move that into existence.
Well, I was about to say come back. So we're definitely going to have to do this. And I want to see that library in New York sure. The next time I visit there. So thank you again, everybody, for showing up. Thank you, Clown Vamp. And thank you, Runtune, for another awesome episode here. Until next time, take care.